From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the US admits a failed rescue attempt was made for journalist James Foley just months before his murder by Islamic State extremists, as details emerge of a ransom demand from his captors.
Paying ransoms or making concessions would both put all Americans overseas at greater risk for kidnapping and in harm's way. Ransoms would also fund and finance exactly the groups we are trying to degrade their capabilities.
Also today, fast food fight. Russia closes 4 McDonald's restaurants in Moscow, citing poor safety standards. And 2 American aid workers infected with the Ebola virus are sent home with a clean bill of health.
For the last 3 weeks, you have been my friends and my family, and so many of you have ministered to me not only physically, but also spiritually.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after a latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. James Foley's employers have said that the jihadists holding the American journalist hostage demanded a ransom of $132 million for his release. The Global Post said Islamic State militants demanded the money last year. Our Washington correspondent Lorna Shattuck reports.
The chief executive and co-founder of Global Post, Philip Balboni, said Mr. Foley's captors asked for $132 million from both the company and the journalist's family. He declined to discuss their reply to the demand, saying only that all relevant communication was shared with US government authorities. But the New York Times newspaper has reported that the United States refused to pay the ransom and that ISIS is currently holding citizens of Britain, which has also declined ransom demands. The Obama administration has revealed that a special operations team tried and failed to rescue James Foley and other American hostages in a secret mission earlier this summer. It's now begun a formal criminal investigation into Mr. Foley's death, with British authorities trying to identify his killer, who spoke with a London accent.
Bank of America has agreed to pay a fine of almost $17 billion to settle claims it missold loans. It's the largest ever settlement between a company and U.S. authorities. Nick Harper reports from New York.
The $16.7 billion settlement for selling risky mortgage-backed securities is equal to Bank of America's profit over the last 3 years. It's the biggest fine in US history, and therefore the largest penalty imposed on a bank for actions that may have contributed to the financial crisis of 2008. It's the latest settlement for Bank of America, which has already spent more than $60 billion since the recession. It's part of a series of fines imposed by the Department of Justice for similar wrongdoing, following on the heels of a $13 billion fine for J.P. Morgan and $7 billion for Citigroup.
2 American aid workers infected with the Ebola virus have been discharged from a hospital in the U.S. city of Atlanta. Doctors at Emory University say Kent Brantley and Nancy Wrightbull have been fully cured and pose no threat to society. U.S. correspondent Simon Marks has more.
The announcement comes as spectacular news for the 2 Americans. Dr. Brantley, a medical missionary in Liberia, says his recovery is a gift from God.
Today is a miraculous day. I'm thrilled to be alive, to be well, and to be reunited with my family.
Dr. Bruce Ribner, the medical director of Emory University, hailed the proof that Ebola patients can be cured.
The discharge from the hospital of both of these patients poses no public health threat.
And doctors say the successful treatment of the 2 Americans will inform attempts to treat Ebola patients on the other side of the world in West Africa.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. According to the Red Cross, Ukraine has begun custom checks on the convoy of Russian trucks reportedly carrying humanitarian supplies headed for eastern Ukraine. The controversial convoy has traveled around 1,000 kilometers from Moscow, but has been stuck near the Ukrainian border for nearly a week amid worries in Kiev and western capitals about Russian intentions in eastern Ukraine. Russia says the trucks are solely carrying humanitarian aid for the benefit of civilians living in the war-torn city of Luhansk. Meanwhile, in Russia, the state food safety watchdog has expanded its crackdown on fast food giant McDonald's for reportedly violating sanitary and nutrition standards. Surprise checks are underway in several of the restaurants across Russia. The move comes after Moscow's ban on food imports from Western countries, which have imposed sanctions on Russia in regards to its actions in Ukraine. And former Irish Prime Minister Albert Reynolds has died at the age of 81. The veteran politician was credited with being instrumental in helping bring about the Northern Ireland peace process. Before entering politics, Mr. Reynolds was a successful businessman, running dance halls, export food businesses, and a pet food company. Natalie Feary reports from the UK.
The leader of the Fianna Fáil political party was part of two coalition governments and served as prime minister for 3 years. The party said his contribution to Northern Ireland and Anglo-Irish relations was his greatest achievement. In relation to helping bring peace to Northern Ireland, it added that his determination brought about what seemed to be impossible. Reynolds also played a crucial role in bringing about the 1994 IRA ceasefire by persuading Republicans to end their commitment to violence. He stood for Irish president in 1997, but was defeated by rival candidate Mary McAleese.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Ahead of the brutal murder of US journalist James Foley by Islamic State militants, the extremists had demanded a $132 million ransom for his release, according to an online news site. US State spokesperson Marie Harf gave this reaction earlier.
We do not make concessions to terrorists. That includes we do not pay ransoms. One of the main ways ISIL has been funded throughout this conflict has been from ransom payments that others have paid. We believe just in 2014, that's in the millions of dollars. So we believe that paying ransoms or making concessions would both put all Americans overseas at greater risk for kidnapping and in harm's way, but that ransoms would also fund and finance exactly the groups we are trying to degrade their capabilities.
The Boston-based Global Post, who Mr. Foley had worked for as a freelance journalist when he was abducted in Syria 2 years ago, say his captors made the demand in 2013. This comes after the Pentagon revealed US commandos had launched a rescue mission this summer for Foley and other hostages, but failed to locate them. Meanwhile, British authorities are searching for a homegrown terrorist who's believed to have carried out the brutal beheading of Mr. Foley. Some sources believe the man, who goes by the name of John, is one of many radicalised British citizens who have joined the ranks of IS. FSN's Ollie Barrett is in London.
Security services are thought to be investigating reports that the militant in the video is the leader of a group of three British fighters in Syria who've become known now as the Beatles because of their English accents. He is reportedly known as John, and his group is said to be holding several foreign hostages. It's thought he's from London, and it's thought to be possible that he was the main negotiator during talks earlier this year to release 11 IS hostages who were eventually handed over to Turkish officials after ransom demands were met. Security Service MI5 are working with the FBI, but also with London's Metropolitan Police, to try and identify this man, John, now in more detail.
Ollie, obviously they have the video to go on, but what will security personnel be looking at in particular?
Officials are said to believe that they can identify John with the help of this gruesome beheading video. Obviously, his voice is on tape. Experts say his accent suggests he's from London or the southeast of England, perhaps with a family link of some sort to Afghanistan. His height and build are also evident on the tape, as is the fact that he's left-handed. So you can see that this begins to narrow things down. The video seems to have been shot with quite high quality television equipment, which makes all of these details a bit clearer for investigators as they study the video. They can see the militant's knife and holster pretty clearly, so they'll be looking to see if they can work out where they might have been purchased. Separate teams will be scanning the video as well for geographic clues as to where it might have been shot. But despite all these advantages, there is the possibility that his voice, John's voice, was dubbed onto the video, and therefore not the voice of whoever killed James Foley. And experts here have also pointed out that up to now, the British jihadists in Syria and Iraq who have been identified have either given their identities to the world themselves via social media, or their friends and family have played a role in working it out. And of course, that may well happen here, because while police do know of dozens of British citizens who have travelled to the region to fight, families and friends are often well aware of this too.
And is there anything that the United Kingdom can actually do to arrest this trend?
Well, it's incredibly hard to get on top of, and it certainly isn't going to happen overnight. Prime Minister David Cameron now under increasing international pressure. I mean, what it looks like we have here is a British citizen killing an American citizen in a foreign war zone. But Mr. Cameron has asked for patience. He knows that even if he can do something to tackle the radicalisation of young Britons, it will take some time, and that more will leave to fight in Syria and Iraq in the near future. I mean, there are government schemes already in place to try and ease this problem, but they haven't had a huge amount of success. Police have repeatedly warned people not to travel abroad to fight, warning them that they will end up charged with terror offences. In May, we actually had the first conviction of a man for a terror offence for arranging to travel to a jihadist training camp in Syria. That came from a tip-off from within the Muslim community, and police will be hoping certainly for more cooperation like that to help them. But they will also be hoping that criminal convictions will put people off attempting to leave this country to fight for the Islamic State.
Ollie Barrett in London. President Obama has backed up his words with action as the US military continued its bombardment of IS jihadists in northern Iraq. The militant featured in the video of James Foley's beheading had threatened the life of another US captive, Stephen Sotloff, if further airstrikes against IS targets were conducted. Vladimir Van Wilgenberg is an international affairs expert based in Erbil, northern Iraq.
Well, in general, of course, they reacted with shock and with utter disgust. In general, they hope now that this video will show to the West what kind of organization the IS is, and that it will motivate the West more to help them fight against the IS. And in general, people are quite shocked, those who have seen the video, and I think most of the officials, they underline that this only shows that that there needs to be more done against the IS.
The United States does not negotiate with terrorists, and the militant dressed from head to toe in black who executed James Foley on that video, he called on Barack Obama to withdraw the military, US military support in northern Iraq and to end those airstrikes targeting ISIS extremists. That obviously was ignored, and military action from the US in that region of Iraq continued again today.
I think US reaction now shows that they're not going to back down and that they can continue with airstrikes. And I think the IS message had had a contradictory reaction. I think the IS didn't expect the Western government seeing this as even a bigger reason to give more support to the Iraqi and the Kurdish government to fight against the IS. Because now also, because it's a British fighter who was speaking on the video, it also brings more fear to Western governments what possibly could happen in their own country when the IS is not being fought against.
And do you have a sense of just how effective these airstrikes, this US military support, is being for those Peshmerga fighters and Iraqi forces?
Well, like, although a lot of people see this as like a new US military intervention, the number of airstrikes is quite limited. If you look to other campaigns like in the past against the Iraqi government of Saddam Hussein and in Afghanistan and in the Yugoslavian, the Kosovo War, so the number of U.S. airstrikes is very, very limited. It's not enough to completely destroy the IS. But what we have seen that the IS, when not stopped by U.S. airstrikes, they could march on very quickly and they could take a lot of territory very quickly. But now we see once the U.S. started to support the Kurds, for instance, with airstrikes, the Kurds immediately pushed out the ISIS, for instance, from some key areas like in Guer and Mahmoud, also in the Mosul Dam, and that was also because of the help of the U.S. airstrikes. But it's also a form of moral support for the Kurds that the Western governments are backing them now.
Vladimir Van Wilgenberg, an international affairs expert based in Erbil, northern Iraq. This is FSN Reports. Two American aid workers infected with the Ebola virus have been discharged from a hospital in Atlanta. Doctors at Emory University say Kent Brantley and Nancy Wrightball have been fully cured and pose no threat to society. Our Washington correspondent Simon Marks reports.
The announcement comes as spectacular news for the two Americans who were airlifted from West Africa, where they contracted the Ebola virus last month. Dr. Brantley, a medical missionary in Liberia with the evangelical organization Samaritan's Purse, described his recovery as a gift from God.
Thank you to Emory University Hospital and especially to the medical staff in the isolation unit. You treated me with expertise, yet with such tenderness and compassion. For the last 3 weeks, you have been my friends and my family. And so many of you have ministered to me not only physically, but also spiritually, which has been an important part of my recovery. I will not forget you and all that you have done for me.
Surgeons revealed that the other patient successfully treated, Nancy Wrightball, was discharged from hospital on Tuesday. She made no public comments, but in a written statement thanked the team at Emory University Hospital for successfully treating the virus. It was a controversial decision when the two patients were flown to Atlanta from West Africa, sparking fears that Ebola could spread in the United States. Held in isolation from the moment they stepped aboard the aircraft that brought them to America, the hospital's medical director, Dr. Bruce Ribner, hailed their successful treatment and suggested it holds a lesson for the public.
As grateful as we are today, our work is far from over. We are very mindful of all of those in West Africa who are still fighting for their lives against this threat and those who are caring for them, putting their own lives in danger. It was the right decision to bring these patients back to Emory for treatment. What we learned in caring for them will help advance the world's understanding of how to treat Ebola virus infections and help, hopefully, to improve survival in parts of the world where patients with this infection are treated.
Dr. Brantley told reporters that he now plans, as he put it, to slip away and spend private time with his family before speaking further about his experiences as an Ebola survivor. He did not indicate whether he plans to return to West Africa, where his missionary work awaits him, but he did urge the public to keep Ebola victims in the region in mind and in their prayers as they try to overcome a disease with a reported mortality rate of 70%. Simon Marks, Washington.
Now, Russia's state food safety watchdog has ordered the suspension of service at four McDonald's restaurants in Moscow and reportedly sealed off part of their premises. The fast food outlets were closed due to sanitary violations and nutritional labelling errors, according to Russian officials. The move comes after sanctions were imposed by the West on Russia over the ongoing Ukraine crisis. Tom Barton is in the Russian capital.
It has closed for McDonald's in Moscow, it says, because of what it calls numerous breaches of sanitary law. Closures and inspections have also expanded across Russia. Now there's a few Russian regions in the south, beyond the Ural Mountains as well, where authorities have also jumped on that bandwagon and said they're going to launch surprise inspections of McDonald's there. Some of them haven't even said the reasons why they would do that or why they think now is the time. But the coincidence is obviously there that this follows the Moscow announcement.
Right.
McDonald's itself says that it is going to look into these closures, these suspensions of operation, try and work out the reasons, what's going on, and try and get those restaurants up and running again as soon as possible.
Okay, so that's the official line. What are analysts viewing this situation saying about this matter? Are they convinced by the sanitary violations?
They are absolutely not convinced by the sanitary violations. It is a coincidence that has happened many times that Rospotrebnadzor, or the consumer health watchdog, usually passes bans on foreign products or finds problems with them at exactly the times that there is political strife involving those countries. It happened with Georgia, it happened with Moldova, with wine from there, it happened with dairy products from Ukraine, it happened with pork from the EU, it happened with fruit from Poland and other countries. The list goes on and on. And nearly always, there is, at that particular time, political tension with the country in question, which has led to the widespread suspicion that these bans are purely a political move designed to hit back by the Kremlin at those that displease it.
So what do these closures mean for, firstly, the staff, who we assume are now out of a job until these restaurants reopen, if they do, and the Russian consumer? Because McDonald's, I imagine, like everywhere else around the world, are immensely popular in Russia.
Well, yes. There are mixed views on the streets. Many Russians that have come up to me as I've been covering this story that have said, why have they done this? And others that have said, well, it's just political games. It's purely a political move to try and do this. They're not fooled at all. There are others, though, who have said things like, about time McDonald's was shut. We don't need to copy Western culture. We have our own cuisine, and we should promote that. The food isn't healthy anyway. There is the case that McDonald's has a long history in Moscow, longer than most Western countries. And one of those restaurants shut was at Pushkin Square, and it was the first McDonald's to open in 1990. And it's still an iconic photo, the huge queues that people that were queuing around the block when that restaurant first opened towards the end of the Soviet Union. Mm. People then very eager for a taste of Western cuisine.
Tom Barton in Moscow. And finally tonight, FSN Spotlight. And with that, here's Simon Marks.
Today on FSN Spotlight, a profile of one of Europe's most activist judges, Baltazar Garzon. For years, he went after global terrorists, drug lords and dictators, including Chile's former leader, General Augusto Pinochet. But when he began delving into crimes allegedly committed in his native Spain during the era of General Franco's fascist rule and probed corruption by the country's Conservative Party, it became apparent that he crossed a line. Garzon ended up barred by the High Court, but he's continued to campaign for justice. Liam Older, a correspondent with the British-based online radio station Monocle 24, sat down with Garzon in the offices of his new foundation.
When in 2013 Spain's High Court ruled unanimously against Judge Baltasar Garzón and barred him from the High Court for 11 years, the news reverberated around the world. To international observers, the deposing of a judge who had fought long and hard to defend international human rights was a surprising development. However, from within Spain, the news story polarized the country in much the same way that the so-called celebrity judge had throughout his long, illustrious career. Garzón's left-wing political leanings had never been a secret. He even stepped down from the bench for a short period to sit in the National Congress as a socialist MP. But his pursuit of Franco-era crimes and corruption inside Spain's Partido Popular Conservative Party marked a turning point. After so many years hunting down malign forces, Garzón was unsurprised that he had made powerful enemies along the way.
Obviously, you garner quite a few. You create a grand catalogue of enemies who all want your head or your position, or to simply kill the person who is making their life so uncomfortable.
Garzón cites the anti-mafia judge Giovanni Falcone, a judge who he both respects and has learnt from, who once told him to be prepared for the attempts to discredit him.
In the end, either you are the subject of slander, or they attack you with defamation through the legal system, or they simply neutralise your life.
As the sentence was delivered, the judge's enemies probably thought they had neutralised the judge. However, since being slapped with the 11-year ban, he has quite typically refused to lay down quietly. Tried by his peers from the High Court, they claimed that he had overstepped his authority by ordering wiretaps on suspects and their lawyers involved in Spain's biggest corruption case, the Caso Gürtel. However, Garzón still maintains the wiretaps were justified. telling me that the detained suspect's criminal activity was continuing from within the prison, and that ordering the wiretaps had even been approved by other judges. Nonetheless, of the over 200 suspects awaiting trial for this massive and ever-growing ring of political corruption, the first and only person to receive a conviction thus far is the very judge who launched the investigation.
Does one mistake override a lifetime's work?
Sometimes that just may well be the case, that this mistake goes on to negate much of your previous work. If the mistake is so severe, it can affect you permanently, because it causes people to forget that which came before it. However, for me, this mistake never existed. I have made many mistakes in my life, but none of them relate to the causes of my suspension from the court or my conviction.
You've described what happened to you as a political sentence. If that's the case, what kind of message was meant for your other peers on the bench?
I think that more than a political judgment, it was a judgment that was predetermined. What happened doesn't make any sense, other than it was simply a means to an end.
Garthon firmly believes his sentence was a warning to other judges to not upset powerful forces within the country. It was a political sentence for an unashamedly political judge, who has since turned up the criticism of Spain's ruling Conservative Party. With preparations for controversial judicial reform and the recent curtailing of the Universal Justice Law, the very same law that allowed Garzón to issue the arrest warrant for former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet, Garzón has been particularly vocal against what he calls a backward step.
This advance, this conquest of humanity to universally protect victims of crime that don't have a nationality, these are crimes that attack the international community. And it is grave indeed that political, economic, and diplomatic reasons are used to protect those in power, especially those that are acting against humankind.
Garzón has also been busy jet-setting around the world. In Argentina, he has been appointed by the government to investigate crimes committed during that country's dictatorship. In Colombia, he has been helping to mediate the FARC peace talks. And back in Europe, he is providing legal counsel to high-profile clients such as Julian Assange. In Madrid, his Human Rights and International Justice Foundation, FIBGAR, is involved in a multitude of international projects, with four offices around the world. And with the Spanish election cycle beginning next year, and the Socialist Party about to launch a new system of primaries to select candidates, many believe that the judge may once again return to the political fray.
What I want to do is participate, but I will not promote myself as a candidate, because it just doesn't interest me at this point in time.
As Garzón continues to fend off questions about his political prospects, he is no less concerned about the state of politics in Spain today.
If people think that judges are not doing what they should be doing, and when they do, that they are persecuted, and persecuted precisely because they are trying to investigate corruption, then this only increases the perception of impunity.
That's Judge Baltazar Garzón talking to Liam Alder of the British-based online radio station Monocle 24. You can hear all their global coverage around the clock by visiting monocle.com. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to contact the show, email us reports@featurestory.com and follow us on Twitter. We're there @featurestory. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside Rebecca Foster with The Bulletin. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.